Hey, you know how Black Friday sales are the best savings of the year? Well, what if we told you Wayfair's bringing Black Friday to July? That's right. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is Black Friday in July. And it's on its way. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Snag outdoor furniture and decor at up to 60% off. Get area rugs for every room at up to 80% off. And refresh your sleep space with up to 60% off bedroom furniture. Plus, way more doorbuster deals on top products and 24-hour surprise flash deals. Oh, and did we mention free shipping on everything? Everything. These are Wayfair's lowest prices of the summer and the best time to make your home even more you. But it only lasts 5 days, so don't miss out. Mark your calendars, then head to Wayfair for up to 80% off Wayfair's biggest sale of the summer. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale, July 24th through 28th, only at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This week, my guest is Aileen Allen, venture partner at Mercury. A native Houstonian, Aileen has spent the bulk of her career in the tech ecosystems of the Bay Area and Austin as an operator at tech companies, eventually returning to her hometown in 2020. She recently evolved her career to become an investor, and she shares some of these learnings on the show today, plus what she's looking for in her new role at Mercury. Aileen, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me, Natalie.
I like how you originally emailed me just to catch up, and I was like, nope, let's do it on a podcast. So thanks for jumping in on that with me. So for those who don't know you, can you go ahead and give us a background, a bit on your background and how you transitioned recently into becoming a full-time investor?
So I grew up in Houston, left for undergrad, went to school in Austin at St. Edward's, and then moved to San Francisco and started my career in software there. I like to say that I accidentally fell into software. I was doing event planning at a small company and started doing events for a GovTech company, and was with them for 6 years. And that role evolved into a variety of marketing responsibilities, and then took over as a product manager for one of the products that that we launched and took to market. I did that for about a year and a half. And I loved being on the product side, but I really enjoy the go-to-market side of the house. And so I was looking for a way to grow my exposure and learn new ways of taking products to market and reaching new audiences. And that's when I landed at a company called Atlassian. And this was in 2013. And I was with Atlassian for 7 years, pre and post IPO. So all through their hyper growth phase. And at the time that I joined, just to put it into context of the type of work I was doing in GovTech, it's very much like, from a go-to-market lens, think high ACV, low volume, low velocity. You know your targeted accounts, you've got a list of all of the cities and counties and municipal districts. And then I went to Atlassian and I was going, you know, where is our CRM? Who are our customers? They're like, welcome to self-serve. Like everything is just done through the website, which, you know, in 2013, this was pretty uncommon for a way for businesses to buy. And so this really piqued my interest and curiosity in product-led growth. And I just became really fascinated with like how, you know, Atlassian was able to build such a successful flywheel model in motion. And at that point, we were north of $400 million in revenue when I joined, just under 1,000 employees. And so I had the opportunity to work on taking our enterprise products to market, interviewing our first account executives. We had a reputation for being, you know, such a successful company with no sales team. And so we eventually like had to evolve that message externally as we brought on sales folks, but just incredible opportunity to build out that part of the business. And then relocated to Austin with Atlassian and built out our office, helped grow our office from the 10 of us that relocated to north of 500 by the time that I left. I was kind of commuting between Austin and San Francisco and then Sydney quarterly. So traveling quite a bit, but I spent 7 years in Austin, six or seven additional years in Austin, mostly with Atlassian during that time, and then relocated to Houston in 2020 and joined a startup called Gremlin and was running all of their marketing and BDR and growth functions. And then another after Gremlin, a company called Fanta, and then a company called TailScale. So I say those quickly because effectively the functional responsibilities of running that part of the business were the same, but with some nuances in terms of like, you know, the strategies behind them.
I think your background is so fascinating because you kind of worked in different stages of companies that probably sets you up really nicely to be a mentor, an advisor, and an investor. So tell me a little bit about how you made the transition and got originally involved as an investor and what you're doing now.
So I started angel investing in 2020, mostly through my network. And when I moved back to Houston, I got connected with the Mercury Fund, you know, spending 17 plus years or so in Austin and San Francisco. I got really accustomed to having a startup and tech ecosystem in my backyard. Moved to Houston and sort of was scratching my head saying, I know it's here, but where is it, right? And I had a VC who connected me with the Mercury team and said, if you want to know where it is, start here. This is the team that you really need to know. And then that led to me meeting more people in the community and doing, at that time at the Ion, we were doing startup pitches. And so they would run those, I think, monthly or quarterly. And so I got to have the opportunity to judge a couple of those startup pitches. And that's how I met Mitra Miller at the Houston Angel Network. She was one of the judges. And I thought, well, that would be incredible as an angel investor to get to go learn from more seasoned and senior and veteran investors. And that just really sparked my curiosity. I also was a limited partner, small tech limited partner in a few funds. And so I'd get all of those quarterly updates, and all of the GPs were really open to me just pinging them with questions as they, you know, would produce their quarterly reports or run any of their annual meetings. And so that was, I think those two avenues just really piqued my curiosity and made me more interested in VC as a long-term career path. And I think the other thing just to note is I've worked for VC-backed companies for the majority of my career and had the opportunity as an executive to be in the boardroom countless times. And one of my sort of like takeaways was very few of my board members kind of looked like me. And by that, I mean, I think I had maybe one or two women on any of my boards at a given time, like in totality in my career. And then very few of my board members had been operators. And I think for me, being an operator, I was eager for them to, eager to find folks who had, you know, relatable experiences. So it's really challenging when you're sitting in the boardroom as an executive and your board member says, you know, did you try this? Did you do that? And they're going, well, if you only knew what it really takes to like make the sausage right at the end of the day. So I thought, well, shoot, like, I'd really like to change that. And I'd like there to be better representation and diversification in the boardroom. And hopefully more investors who understand the challenges and nuances of actually building a business and being on the operator side. So those were things that really sparked my curiosity and drive to become an investor full time.
Yeah, I think we get caught up a bit in the stats of like, you know, how many women investors there are and whatever, but it's like nothing beats that firsthand experience you had by seeing the people in the room, in the meeting, at the table, and then being able to like picture yourself and then make it happen to take up one of those seats in the future. So I think that's really interesting. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on, but I'm very curious to hear your perspective as a native Houstonian working in the Bay Area and then coming back to Houston and seeing it with that background of the tech ecosystem on the West Coast. So what were your first impressions on Houston's tech ecosystem, the good and the bad? I want to know them both.
Yeah, I think my first impression was, where is it? And again, like, take it with a little bit of grain of salt that I moved back in the summer of 2020, right? Where like people just weren't getting together in person. But yeah, like Bay Area plus Austin, right? Where there's a very thriving tech and startup ecosystem in Austin too. And so I think that was my big impression. And I thought, okay, well, you know, be the change you seek. How do you get involved, right? Like, I'm a big believer of you get out of things what you put into them. And so I sought to just go find it. And that's how I found the Ion and the Mercury team and became an advisor to their portfolio company and got involved in the Houston Angel Network and started just meeting founders at various events. There's this great female founders and funders event that happens monthly at SheSpace. So there's a ton of meetups that are actually happening that it feels like there's something that's happening in Houston, but it's almost like smaller and maybe a little bit more fragmented. And I think there's an opportunity for a lot of us, you know, on the VC, on the investing side, and maybe founders who have had successful exits or who are running companies at scale, you know, to do more and give back in more meaningful ways and create that presence that I think, you know, Austin is really well known for, and obviously the Bay Area is really well known for.
Yeah, I wonder if, so with Austin and the Bay Area too, which I have limited experience with personally, is it just that there's these parts, like these physical locations that are just like hubs where there's just like downtown for Austin, I know is big. Does Houston have that? Like, we don't have a central hub. We're very spread out. We've got founders across the city, which is so much more than even a city with when you think about like our suburbs and everything. So is it like a sprawl problem that Houston has, do you think?
I think that's a contributing factor to it. Yeah, absolutely. But I think there's also like, we've got, you know, a dozen or so companies that we can point to that have had very successful exits as within the software space. And I think we need more of those to put us on the map who can then kind of spawn smaller startups. And we need those founders to stay in Houston. So I've met founders who have relocated to Austin, and then I've met Austin founders who have relocated to the Bay Area, right? Or, you know, we have a founder in our portfolio who started in Houston and moved to the Bay Area. And I think it's feedback that I've received recently from two different founders was, you know, we're relocating back to the Bay Area because it's access to talent and it's access to capital. And that was super disappointing to hear, you know, especially in the role that I'm in. And I said, can you just elaborate on that? And they said, well, one said, yeah, sure. Like on the talent side, like I can walk into any coffee shop, you know, in SF, and there's a Stripe engineer and there's a, you know, insert whatever software company engineer. Like they're so easily accessible anywhere you go. And the same to be said, I think on the capital side, and we kind of pulled on that thread on capital because that one was the one, you know, obviously in my current role that really mattered to me to really understand his perception. And he said, look, like the capital exists in Texas, but there's so much more risk tolerance in the Bay Area. And there are a lot more people with capital willing to write checks. In Texas, he said, he felt like he had to convince investors more than he does in the Bay Area. He said, I could just kind of pitch them on an idea. And so maybe it's really early stage investors that he was referring to, but I think that's another reason why, you know, maybe Houston, it doesn't feel like that exists here. It's, and frankly, there aren't a lot of VCs in Houston, right? And there aren't a lot of software engineers in Houston, maybe compared to the Bay Area on a per capita basis.
I know that there are founders listening enthusiastically, nodding to this, shaking their headphones out because they're nodding so hard to what you're saying. So I think that makes a lot of sense. But you are now very active in organizations that are, you know, trying so hard to change this. So one of them being Fond. So tell me about, you know, taking this meeting with Mitra and turning it into, you know, being a board member for Fond and what y'all are working on now.
Yeah, I'm really proud of how Fond has evolved over the last 2 or 3 years. And I don't want to in any way imply that I can take credit for this, but I remember sitting with Mitra at the ION and saying, look, we've got to change the representation of our members, right? My first meeting that I went to, my first Han meeting, I think I was one of 3 or 4 women in the room, and most people were retired men. And I thought, well, these people don't represent me. I'll probably learn something from them, but like, this isn't a group that I, you know, would maybe like naturally gravitate towards, right? And then that might sound really ignorant, but that's the reality. And I'm really happy to say, you know, roughly or just a little bit north of 20% of our membership today are women. And we have a great group of diverse backgrounds of people, diverse age ranges. We've made adjustments to the way in which we allow people to write checks. So, you know, we obviously, a lot of companies will have a minimum threshold because they want to keep their cap tables clean. And we said, okay, well, we can try things like SPVs to help with that so that some investors can write smaller checks if they're not comfortable writing use the example of 25,000 tends to be the minimum check size we hear from a lot of founders coming to us. And so we say, okay, well, maybe there's a way that we can pull some money together across members and make this work for people so that we can get investors from diverse backgrounds.
Well, I think your impact is definitely recognized. I know it's a group effort, and Mitra has been on the show before and talked a little bit about some of the things she's accomplishing too at Han. So thanks for sharing that. And we're excited to celebrate at the Houston Innovation Awards because Han is a finalist in the Community Champion Organization category, which is a new one this year. So for those interested in Han, definitely come out to the awards and talk to someone from Han about that. So the other organization, which you've mentioned a couple times too, that you've been involved with is Mercury, and you guys made it official joining when you joined as venture partner in June. So tell me a little bit about your role and what you're focused on.
So I've known the team for several years and joined as a venture advisor probably about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, which is just a fancy way of saying like I was available to anybody in their portfolio if they wanted to talk about go-to-market strategy, in particular across B2B SaaS, right? And my background, the majority of my career was spent in developer tools and infrastructure. So I kind of gravitate towards what I call affectionately technical products for technical audiences. And there's quite a lot of those in the Mercury portfolio. So I had gotten to know several of their founders and CEOs really well. And probably about 18 months ago or so, I thought, you know, I'd like to get serious about making this transition into VC and how would I go about doing that? So I did a ton of informational interviews. I've got a Google Doc of 30 plus conversations that I had with people and just said, you know, how does a go-to-market operator transition into VC? It's an unusual path. If you think about VC, it tends to, you know, at least my impression is it's finance and investment bankers, or if they are operators, they're more often than not founders themselves who have gone into VC. Very, very few of them are marketers or growth operators, right? And so I just started like hitting my network and learning as much as I could about what that path could look like. And one of those people is a mentor of mine, Aziz, and he, you know, just did a ton of coffees with me and gave me some great feedback and also told me why it might be a terrible idea to go into VC, which is sometimes the conversation you really need to have. And one of the things that he recommended was BC University through NVCA and UC Berkeley School of Law. So I signed up for that course and took that class at the start of the year. And as I was wrapping that up, I did effectively like an internship with one of the VCs that I'm an LP in called Stage 2 Capital. Spent 3 months with them just learning a lot about what the role would be, and that you know, just accelerated my interest in wanting to be, and really like accelerated my interest and reaffirmed that this is what I wanted to be doing. So as I was winding that down, I reached out to Mercury and just said, look, like this is really the path that I'm on. And they said, well, let's talk. And what if you come on over as a venture partner and spend, you know, the majority of your time with us doing all things investing? So help with deal sourcing and doing diligence on any deals that you're really excited about, eventually writing a check, eventually taking a board seat, and supporting our portfolio companies and however, you know, whatever form or fashion that could come in. And so I sort of said, heck yeah, let's do it. So I joined earlier this year, and, you know, Mercury invests in, and I'm sure you know this, Natalie, but for those who may not know Mercury, we invest in early stage B2B SaaS companies across Middle America. And we ideally will write a seed to Series A check. And my hope, my personal goal was, okay, within the first 6 months of my time at Mercury, I'd like to write one of those seed checks, like find a company that I'm really excited about, very early stage, and write my first check. And I'm excited to share, and I can share this because the news went live this week, which is I was able to find a deal and champion it. And it was a later stage Series A deal. And so I, you know, got to follow and shadow one of our managing partners through that whole process and just learned a ton. And I think that's my big sort of takeaway from 2024 is like, always be learning, always be curious. I feel like I've been telling so many people this, I'm at the bottom of the learning curve, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to get past the bottom of it, which isn't true, but there's just so much new to learn in this role, especially as somebody who's been an operator and has done you know, by and large, the same role for 17 years, but in different companies that has a, you know, a different flavor each time. But getting to join a team at Mercury who are seasoned, experienced, it's been just an incredible few months.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, congratulations on the first check. What exactly can you tell us about that deal and other deals you're working on, even if it needs to be like a bit broad and kind of what exactly, what types of companies you're looking for?
Sure. So we look for early stage. So seed, we would say we'd like to see about $1 million in revenue. Series A is, you know, about $3 million in revenue is a safe benchmark. And there are other SaaS metrics that we'd like to see around, you know, year-on-year growth, gross margins, your net revenue or gross revenue retention. Those are the key things that we'd like to look at for any good investment. And for me, I mentioned this earlier, I spent most of my career in developer tools and infrastructure and that kind of phrase of technical products for technical audiences. That's what I gravitate towards when I'm looking at investments, because that's what I feel like I know really well. But I also know go-to-market tech because I was a go-to-market leader for so many years. And that was the first investment that the first check that I was able to write was in for sales technology. And so I, you know, I want to stay open. I don't want to stay overly focused on a particular theme or thesis, because again, I think it's important to always be learning and looking for unique opportunities wherever they live.
Well, one of the things that we were talking about, how you made that transition, it's so interesting to me that you did all of those informational interviews. You did so much homework, which I love. And I think more people need to do more homework, I think, like that, before making big moves like that. But what were your key takeaways of all of that learning, you know, from Aziz and from all the other different people you talked with? I wonder if you could boil it down to a couple of things that you learned that really maybe made you more interested, maybe more aware when making the transition into VC.
I'm thinking, sorry. It's a great question. It's a great question. No, yeah, because I'm trying to decouple that from my learnings of just in the role, right? So I'll share a couple of things that people told me when I was picking their brains, which is, it's very different from any operating job you've ever had. Very few people could really explain what that meant. And so the way that I would describe it is, you know, there's a lot of unstructured time and unstructured work. So Mondays at a lot of VC firms tend to be internal meetings. So there's partner meetings, there's pipeline meetings, there's firm-wide meetings, you know, there's just that day is like firm day. And then the other 4 days, you're filling your time talking to founders, getting introductions, meeting other VCs, reading reports, just learning the space that you're really curious about, and hoping all of that leads to a really interesting deal, right? And so that is, you know, pretty unusual for me as an operator. I would have my team meetings, I'd have one-on-ones, I'd have other exec meetings, I'd have, you know, what, you know, meetings with customers, whatever it was. And those were standing meetings. And then I come to the VC side and it's just unstructured work is the best way to describe it. And there's sort of this hustle mentality that, you know, you need to have, I think, that I hope I don't lose, right? Like I'm fortunate enough to work at a firm that has a very reputable brand, recognizable and reputable brand, but I don't as a VC yet, right? And so anybody who knows me professionally knows me from my operator experience. And so it's important for me to continuously meet new people and build that brand as an investor. And so I think that's another like lesson learned, right? Is like, sure, you can build your brand as an operator, but it's a very different brand as an investor. And what can I bring to the table for a founder and really identifying, you know, what makes me unique? So there's this concept that VCs often ask founders, which is, what is your unfair advantage? And I sat in a room with Samantha Lewis, who's a partner at Mercury, and we just brainstormed this for a little while. And we just said, well, what do we think our unfair advantage as VCs are? And not just Mercury, but Samantha and Aileen, right? Like, what really sets us apart and differentiates us from other investors that founders are talking to? And it was a really eye-opening moment of just like, I think recognizing that I do have something really valuable to provide founders, even if it's not that, you know, air quotes, pattern recognition that a lot of VCs who have been doing investing for decades have, right? What I bring is the go-to-market operator lens, and obviously founder empathy and executive team empathy. And then, of course, a lot of what I'm learning as an investor. And so that was a really neat, a neat kind of like moment, I think, for me and hopefully for Samantha, of like, here's what we can offer and here's what we can provide. And we're really excited to be partners with some of the founders that we get to work with as a result of that.
That's such a cool way to think of that. And I know any founders listening need to look inside themselves and answer that unfair advantage question, especially before they come knocking at Mercury's door, right? So when it comes to startups that you work with, and you have a little bit already, but revisit what expertise you bring to the table for the startups you work with, and what is your go-to advice for them? Like, if you could pick just like one thing you want startups to know, what should they know?
Ooh, one thing. Okay. So I tend to do a lot of coaching and advising with early stage founders, very early stage founders in Houston. So I recently got to participate with Jeep Beta, and I try to find ways to like mentor. And what I tend to look at is, okay, yes, tell me what the problem is that you're solving, but who are you solving it for? And do you have a really clear picture of that? So, you know, there's this acronym called ICP. So who's your ideal customer profile? And within that customer profile, who are the key decision makers and influencers that you need to win and convince them that you have the right solution to their problem? And then I look at, okay, then how do we message the solution to them? And then how do we take that message to them? So that's effectively go to market, right? Like in a very small nutshell. So who are we trying to convince? And how are we convincing them? And like, what are the levers we can pull to convince them? So I tend to look at like that with a lot of the early stage companies that I talk to. And then often, you know, some of the mentoring and coaching is just around narrative and pitch and position. So how are you pitching investors? And how are you, you know, do you have a really succinct and clear message on what the value is the value and the differentiation that your solution provides? And then similarly, like, how do we massage that for the customer base that you're trying to attract? So I tend to look at I tend to spend a lot of time with founders on go-to-market, and that's a high level response for you, because sometimes it gets really, really tactical where I'm reviewing messaging docs or I'm reviewing, you know, ad copy or something, right? Like it can be really, really tactical, but in a nutshell, it's all of their go-to-market strategy.
Messaging is so important. So there's so much that could be done under that umbrella, but I like the idea of like picturing that person that you're solving the problem for too. So I feel like putting people at the front, like in the scope of things, is so important in business. And I think we don't talk about that enough. So finding that person angle to it is very interesting. It resonates.
Yeah. Even if it's B2B, at the end of the day, it's person on the other end, right? And so you can get really creative, but it needs to be authentic and it needs to be honest, and like don't lose sight of the fact that you are actually talking to another person. Or I can't tell you how many times I've like read copy where I'm like, that's a lot of jargon, like that doesn't mean anything to me, right? Like speak in human speak when possible.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's a person making that purchase, whether they're doing it for their company or for themselves. So that's a great reminder. While we're talking advice, I think maybe to wrap up, since you mentioned early on in the episode how passionate you were about crossing over onto the VC side of things, just to be able to see more of representation from a female perspective. So for women who are interested in making this transition like you have and doing all of the homework that you've done and all the informational interviews that you've done, what would you tell aspiring female investors, and maybe specifically some ways they can get involved with Houston?
I'm still learning it myself, to be honest, but I would say just get involved, right? Find your allies, find your champions, find your Mitra Millers in the community, right? People who can mentor you as you're, you know, kind of growing up in investing. And don't be shy. Don't, you know, ask the questions. Like there's a lot of acronyms, there's a lot of new terminology, and a lot of people will just tell you once you start asking questions, they're like, it means this, right? Like I don't really know why we call it that thing, but it really just means this at the end of the day. There are a ton of great resources out there, like really good podcasts and sort of these key books that everyone should read, right? Like read Venture Deals, I can follow up with you, Natalie, with like a list of the things that I feel like are kind of like the core principles, like books that everyone consumes and reads in VC. So I don't know if that's a really helpful answer or not, but I would say just go out there and try and do it and try and network and make asks. And that's like a lot of the feedback that I give to female founders too, is like, just always be out there making the ask, right? Like, don't be passive. Do what you can do if this is the space that you're interested in, and try and find ways to get introductions. I think that's a really important part. Like, VC is a very heavy network-driven industry, and if you can get introductions to other investors and VCs, then it'll open up a lot of doors.
It's such a great reminder, even though it sounds intuitive to, you know, ask the question, but women like hesitate to ask for help. I think it's something that's kind of held us back, and it is a broad generalization, but I do think it's a great reminder, like, ask the question, ask for help, meet the people that can help you, because it's not in our nature. It's like, we want to do it ourselves, but how you do it yourself is by getting help.
Yeah. I made this comment the other day. So I had the chance to speak on a panel as part of Ty Houston. They had women founders were pitching for an opportunity to present in Bangalore at their annual summit. And we had three finalists represented from Houston. And I was sharing with them earlier in the day, I had done a mentoring ring with five founders. Three of them were women. And I had to give like the recognition that after the meeting, the three people who followed up with me were those three women, those three female founders, and like, good on them, right? And only one of them had an ask though, right? Like, two of them were just saying, you know, thanks for your time. It was great. I appreciated you said these things. They took notes, they paid attention, but only one had a follow-up ask for me. Like, okay, like that's some progress, but like, just don't be shy. Like, even if I can't find the time like next week to meet with you, like, you should still just get in the habit of asking for introductions to my network or asking for coffee or whatever it is, right? Like, do something to try and stay engaged if I am the right type of investor for you, right? Or if I could be a helpful mentor or advisor to you long-term. And the reality is maybe I didn't fit what they were looking for, but I do want to like at least recognize that they were the three who took the action to follow up.
Well, I think that's such a great reminder. And like I said, it may sound intuitive, but to hear it from you, from someone making those decisions on the investor side, I think that is very helpful to startups and potential future investors. So thank you so much for all of that, all of your advice and sharing your story. And it's very cool to have you here in Houston. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.